tape 5, side 1, continuing our interview with Mr. William Block.
Maxine's father was killed in an automobile accident on the New York Thruway, and I would say it was probably in the late 60s or early 70s. They had trying to remember now, but I called up a friend of mine at the Albany Times Union, which is a Hearst newspaper, and Mr. Gene Robb, who I had known over some years, and I asked him. Maxine and I had flown over to Albany, and we were in a hotel there. And Maxine's mother was in the hospital. She was not present at the funeral because she was in the hospital. She had a kidney injury. And so we handled the funeral arrangements, and I thought I'd better get a lawyer rather quickly because the accident took place on the thruway. And I called up Mr. Robb and asked what lawyers they used and could he recommend other lawyers that might do this kind of work, negligence work. And so he gave me the name of two firms, and I found that one of them was across the street from the hotel. And so, being lazy, I went to that firm, and I told one of the partners what my objective was, and he introduced me to a young man who I found had gone to Harvard Law School, so I thought, well, I'm in pretty good hands. Well, the first thing they did very quickly was to send out and take some pictures of where the scene of the accident. Now, what had happened was that a young woman driving a car with a Vermont license, reason being that in New York you have to have insurance, but you don't have to in Vermont. So she went off the highway onto the berm, and she was trying to get back on the highway. And she was turning, and there was a lip there. And she couldn't seem to get the wheel over the lip to get on, and so she kept turning. And finally, she gave it a jerk, and the car veered over into the roadway and veered right into his car and hit him on the driver's side. And Anne was thrown out of the car. I don't know how this all happened. The car rolled over, I think. So anyway, this young lawyer took pictures out there right away, and so we were able to sue the thruway and get some settlement. It wasn't great, because here he was, retired, in his 60s, and, you know, they judge these awards on the basis of what your potential earnings are. Well, his potential earnings weren't that great at that age, even though he was doing some work, but because he was very clever in construction work, and he had sort of half-built the houses they were in, or changed them, and so forth.
Where were they living at that time?
They were living in a small community outside of Albany called South Bethlehem. And so anyway, but this young, the reason I tell you about this young lawyer is that he took such a wonderful interest in Anne, who always was she was a very slight woman, had a very almost like a a little bird, and people always seemed to want to take care of her. She had a marvelous way of having people help her. And I suppose it was partly her appearance, partly her manner, but she always had lots of people who were willing to go the last mile to help her. Well, this young lawyer took a great shine to her, and he was just marvelous to her. And he would visit her, and he would, long after this case was settled, he helped her. She settled in after his death. She moved to an apartment in a neighboring town. I can't remember exactly where it was now. It was up the Mohawk Valley, or should I say, up the Mohawk Valley. And it might have been, where was the Beechnut Factory? I can't remember now, up there. But that's an area they had always known well. The Hortons were farmers. And Aubrey Horton, Maxine's father, was the only one who never was interested in farming. All the other Hortons owned land in that area near the Mohawk River and were dairy farmers or other kinds of farmers. And so she went up to one of these one of the towns up the Mohawk, and we went up there and helped her get settled in a very nice apartment there. But she soon tired of that and decided she wanted to go live with one of her daughters in California. She realized that our schedule was so hectic, and she didn't really, she liked a much more relaxed life, and she knew that we lived a very busy and rather intense life in this newspaper field. So she wanted to go out to California, and she did. And sure enough, she meets a man who was quite a bit younger than she, and he was obviously a man who wanted a mother and wanted to help take care of somebody. And they were married. His name was Paul Arnold. And he was a very nice man. And they moved, after they were married, to Fort Myers, Florida. And they lived there quite a long while. Actually, they lived at Fort Myers Beach. And he died quite a long time before she did. He had some kind of stroke or heart. And so we went down there to Fort Myers. It was in the summer. I've never been so hot in my life. And much to her shock, the day we arrived, I put her house up for sale. And I made arrangements to sell his car, because I knew she didn't drive. And the whole the thing was being done so quickly that I think it just overwhelmed her. But I mean, if there was no reason for her to stay there alone. So anyway, we sold the house in fairly short time, and we sold the car in fairly short time, and we shipped everything out to California that was worth shipping, and left the rest and brought her back to Pittsburgh with us, and she stayed with us a while, and then she went out to California again, and she lived with Maxine's youngest sister, and that's where she was when she died. I told you pretty much what I know about that family.
Now, let's get back to Maxine and you. You had your child in New Haven, and then what was the next step?
Well, then we went out to, after I was finished that Japanese course, I was sent down to a course in psychological warfare in Washington, D.C., which was only about a week or so, and then we were assigned to the Presidio Monterey in Monterey, California, which was a staging area for these language, the language people, and those who had studied Japanese. So I went out there. We drove out, and of course we had with us Bill Jr., who was maybe, I forget now, well, he was born in November, and this was, we were going out in June or late May, so he was 6 months old, something like that. And I remember having terrible difficulty in Reno, Nevada, trying to find a place to stay. And we had been coming across the desert all day, and it was very, very hot. And Bill Jr. was red in the face and screamed at the top of his lungs. And every place we stopped to try to get accommodations, they must have looked out and saw this child screaming and wonder what kind of parents does he have? What'd they do to this child?
Sure, they thought you were beating him.
Beating. So I couldn't find anything. So desperate, I went into the newspaper. And I introduced myself and told them my newspaper connections. And I talked to the managing editor, and he picked up the phone and got an accommodation immediately at a place that had already turned us down. So we were at the Riverside Hotel or whatever it was in Reno for a night. And then the young man cooled off and was okay the next day, and off we went. We had with us a woman who wanted to come to California, who we had met in New Haven. And she helped take care of Bill Jr. for us, and was also enjoying the opportunity of taking this ride to California. So, anyway, we arrived at the Presidio of Monterey, and we had a terrible time finding accommodations. A friend of ours in San Francisco had made a reservation for 3 days at this motel, and that's as long as they would take us, and then 2 days at another motel. And we were going to be running around like chickens with their heads cut off. There were 60,000 troops at Fort Ord, California, which was right near Monterey, and a tremendous number of people coming into this language center. military government groups, which is what I was assigned to then. And so Maxine said, well, you know, when you ship out, I want to stay here. So we started to look around for a place to buy. Well, of course, I was horrified at the housing in California. There was no basement, and there was no attic. And here was a little box that sat on a piece of ground, and they wanted a pretty good price for it. But it cost nothing like today. So I think for $18,000, we bought a house. We put something down on it and so forth. And we moved in there, and I was there maybe 2 months, something like that. Let's see, we arrived in June, and I shipped out about VJ Day. And we, of course, when the bomb was dropped, the nuclear bomb, that was music to our ears, because that meant we were not going to be part of an invasion of Japan. I've just been reading the Truman book.
We're just talking about it. It just started.
And the casualties they expected.
That's right.
In an invasion of Japan.
That's right.
Frightening. So, you know, those of us who knew that we were part of that invasion were not reluctant to see the bomb dropped, even though we recognized that there were the implications of it for the future were not that great. Anyway, we bought this little house on the Mesa in Carmel. And Maxine stayed there while I was overseas about 10 months. And she stayed there with Bill Jr. And when I came back, we sold the place and that's when we came back to Pittsburgh. We arrived, I think I've told you that story already. I think you taped that about the film of soot on the glass of milk. Well, that was the morning we arrived in Pittsburgh and stayed at what was then the Shenley Hotel. And Maxine now is she's a dyed-in-the-wool Pittsburgher, but that was her first experience being. I think that's pretty much the story of the sequence of events and some of the family.
Then your second child was born.
Oh, here in Pittsburgh in 1947.
And where did you live?
When we first got back, we rented on Mount Royal Road off of Forward in Squirrel Hill. And we rented there, I think we got a 6 month rental. And then we bought a house in Oakmont, on 12th Street in Oakmont, not far from the Oakmont Country Club. And it was a nice house. It was owned by a man named Overly, who had an envelope and stationery company on Forbes as you went out toward Wilkinsburg. And Mr. Overly sold the place to us. We stayed there about 5 years. And then
The second child was whom?
Hmm?
The second child was whom? Born in
Karen. Our second child is Karen, who was born in 47. Barbara was born in May of 49. And Donald, our fourth child, was born in 53. So they were all, of course, born at McGee Hospital. Only Bill was born in New Haven. So we were in Oakmont about 5 years, but you know, more and more there were lights and stop signs, and it was getting slower and slower trying to come in to Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh was very much my life. I was out a lot of evenings in Pittsburgh, various functions, and we liked the symphony on Friday nights. And it got burdensome to be out there. So we decided to move into town. And I learned from a man I knew that the Waltons, that's a son of John Walton, I think was son-in-law of W.L. Mellon. And that they were selling a house that they owned on Warwick Terrace, which they had been renting to a lawyer from Coppers. And a lawyer from Coppers had decided to buy a house, and he was moving out, and the Waltons had decided to sell this house. It was 5050 Warwick Terrace. And then we bought that in 52. We had moved to Oakmont in 47, and we bought this in 52. And it was an old house. It was a house that had been built by Joe Guffey, famous for the Guffey Coal and Iron Police, the bill that barred Coal and Iron Police, and became a senator. He had been in the oil business, always hated the Mellons because he thought that they had done him out of his oil company. He sold out to Gulf. I don't know the reasons involved, but he always was very bitter about that. Well, anyway, he built this house in 1915. And when I told Mayor Lawrence that I was that I had moved into Joe Guffey's old house, he said, "Oh," he said, "I know that house very well." He said, "I used to go up there for meetings." He said, "When Joe Guffey and I were about the only Democrats in Allegheny County." So he knew that house well. And we enjoyed the house when we were there 25 years. And then when all the children were grown, you know, and pretty much out either on their own or at college or something like that, Maxine said, "You know, this house is much too big. We don't need a house this big." So I said, "Well, if you can move and find me a swimming pool," which is what I've always enjoyed. So she finds a place in Fox Chapel. This was in 76, I think. And we moved out on Hillcrest Road in Fox Chapel. Well, it was a very nice place and very beautiful area. But the next two winters, 76-77 winter and the 77-78 winter were two of the worst winters we've had in Pittsburgh over the years. And I just hated that commuting. And I also thought the road between Etna and Millvale in those days, now it has a separator, but in those days it didn't. I thought it was the most dangerous piece of road, and I was there, and of course mostly in the dark because I worked late. And I just, I was very unhappy there, and I kept grousing. And finally Maxine said, "All right, we'll move back into town." So she started to look around and didn't find anything. And then finally one day, Little Goldsmith, probably know Ken Goldsmith's wife, who does some real estate work, called us and said, "I think I found the house that you would like." And it's at the end of Fair Oak Street, overlooks Carnegie, Forbes Street, Forbes Avenue, and Carnegie Mellon. And it's a very modern house. It was designed by a man at Carnegie Mellon who was designing it actually for himself and went to all the trouble of gathering the little bits of real estate he needed to build this house. And I can't think of his name right now, but he was teaching architecture at Carnegie Mellon. And just about the time he was getting ready after he had the designs and he gathered the land, and he was getting ready to build the house, he got an offer from Yale and decided to accept it. So he sold it to accomplish it. My name, memory is terrible. But anyway, a retired engineer from Copper's company, or one of the companies, who had been his neighbor over on Aylesboro. And he went on to build it, changed the plan somewhat because the architect had several children, and this man and his wife were older and didn't have any children living with them. And so they built the house, and they were in it, I think 10 or 12 years. And he died, and she decided to sell it. That's when we bought it, and we've been in it now about 13 years, I think, since about 1980. And it's not what I would call a practical house for Pittsburgh. It's a California-style house with a lot of glass. Now, glass is fine if you don't have too much hot weather. Glass is fine if you don't have too much cold weather. It's great for Southern California, but I don't think it's exactly ideal for Pittsburgh. We use a lot of air conditioning in the summer and a lot of heat in the winter. But it's a very, Maxine loves it, and so that's what counts. She's in it a lot more than I am. So.
Now, your children, Where did they go to school?
Bill Jr. started at Whiteman and was in Whiteman, I think, 4 years. And he was sort of a dreamer. He wasn't exactly, he's not dumb. He's pretty bright, but he just didn't work at it much, and he didn't pay much attention. And we just felt that the classes, because of the size of the classes, he was getting away with murder. And so we moved him to St. Edmunds. And Mrs. Swango, who taught fifth grade, she accomplished miracles with that young man and really turned him around a good deal. Nothing like one or two good teachers
That's
in your
what it
life.
Takes.
And he did very well. He went from there to Hotchkiss in Lakeville, Connecticut, which is where I had gone to prep school. He did not like it at all, but he didn't ever say anything to us about not liking it, because he knew that I had so much loyalty to it, and he didn't want to, which was too bad, because he didn't have a very happy time there. And then he went to Trinity in Hartford.
Very good school.
And he enjoyed Trinity, had a good time there. And he decided when he got out of Trinity that he would study law. And he went to Washington and Lee Law School in Lexington, Virginia. By that time, I think he was married, or shortly after. I know. Part of the time he was at Washington Lee, he was married.
To?
Carol Zurheide. Carol's father was with PPG here. He was an engineer in the fiberglass division. And Carol went to Chatham. A great advocate of Chatham. She liked it a great deal. So, and they have three daughters.
Miss Hyperball?
Mm-hmm.
Miss Hyperball? I said Miss Hyperball?
Oh, yes. Yes. She's the youngest. She's the 10-year-old. And the oldest, I think we've gone in this, the oldest is at Yale, will be a junior this coming in September. And the middle one, Nancy, is a junior in high school.
Did your son finish law school?
Yes, but his time was interrupted by service in the Army, and he was in Vietnam for a year. And then when he got back from Vietnam, he went back and completed law school.
Excuse me, how do you spell Zurheide?
Z-U-R-H-E-I-D-E.
Did he ever practice law?
No, he never practiced law. He went to the newspaper business when he got out of law school. He passed the bar, Pennsylvania bar. He could practice. He passed the bar exam, yeah. And Karen went to the University of Rochester. Oh, she also started at Whiteman. And about the time we moved Bill and Barbie was starting school, we decided to move Karen to Ellis, and Barb started at Ellis. I don't think Barb ever attended White.
End of side one, take five. Continued on side two.
Ellis all the way through the 12th grade.